What's up, everybody? Welcome in episode 279 of Living Off the Land. How's everybody doing out there? Appreciate you guys listening. Another episode, another week. And I'm Dan, here with my co-host, Steven. And Steven, it's Wednesday night.
You know what that means? That means we're going to have ourselves a dandy of a show tonight. We've got tons and tons of talk, baseball, basketball, golf, and a whole bunch of other stuff as well. But we start off, of course, with the beer of the week. Dan, take it away.
Yeah, I've actually got a beer this week. It's one we've done before, obviously. I say that every week because, you know, doing as many episodes of this podcast as I've done, it's hard to find beer that I haven't had that's local. But anyway.
Getting even harder these days with the consolidation of some of these
Yeah. Pubs
and, you know, places closing.
So anyway, this is one we've had before, obviously. It is interestingly enough, we are getting into the springtime, and hopefully, boy, we are just trying to grab it up from the depths, this warm weather. We had a couple good days to start this week. It's cooled off a little bit today, and then tomorrow and Friday is going to be cold and wet and rainy and typical April BS, and it doesn't look like I'm going to be able to golf by my birthday.
So, now, unless if you went Monday or Tuesday.
I didn't.
You
I
had
didn't,
a good so. Shot then, but unfortunately Monday and Tuesday are not easy to get out, obviously. So
yeah. So anyway, I have a stout, a peanut butter vanilla coffee stout, to be exact, a local favorite from Saucy Brewworks. This is their What's His Nuts. And shout out Jimmy Pisarczyk. He's a big fan of this beer. Just kidding. He's not allowed to drink this beer because he's allergic to peanuts. So anyway.
So how are these nuts?
Well, I don't know whose nuts you're talking about. I'm talking that's not what the beer is. But What's His Nuts from Saucy Brewworks is a great beer. It is absolutely, you know, I feel like I say this a lot, so it kind of maybe comes off as hyperbolic, but this is absolutely one of my favorite beers. And Saucy is one of my favorite breweries, and I am trying to find what
one of the very first shows I did with you guys way back when the podcast started was on location at Saucy Brewworks.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah. When we we were up above the, we were just above the speaker that was calling out the orders. So
that was funny. Two tiered brewery offering house made European style beer and customizable thin crust pizzas, which apparently are very, very good. I've never had it. I need to have it one of these times. Main location at 2885 Detroit Road in Cleveland, right in Ohio City. Saucy.
Yeah, Saucy's very good, very good. I was actually at their Columbus location on Saturday. I was down in Columbus, went to a Blue Jackets game. It's a much smaller place than the one in Ohio City, but they also have a Saucy Brewer's coffee shop attached to it, which is pretty cool. I've never had Saucy's coffee. I'm going to have to try that. But in the past, I have rated this an 8.2. I'm going to stick with that. This is a excellent, excellent beer. Anything in the eights is absolutely delicious. This is an ale brewed with milk, sugar, coffee, vanilla beans, and natural flavors added. 7.5% alcohol by volume. It is brewed and packaged by Saucy Brewworks in Cleveland, Ohio. And, it's one of my favorite beers. So that is what I will be drinking during this episode. That is your beer of the week. What's His Nuts by Saucy Brewworks.
Fantastic. And just before I get into Better Know a Neighborhood, I just got to ask you, where were you during the eclipse?
I was about 10 feet that way. I was out of my back patio.
Oh, that must have been just fantastic.
Yeah. You?
I was in a park near the Akron Zoo, actually. which meant that I got maybe just slightly less totality than some of the folks up here did, but it was still pretty astounding when it happened. I posted on Instagram on Monday the video of me actually as it went through the through totality, and right before totality, I had the presence of mind to actually turn my camera away from the sky and toward my shadow on the ground, and it was just crazy. Like within 20 seconds, it's like, here's the shadow. Now you can't see it anymore.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. It's like freaky.
It was pretty amazing how quickly it just came about. Like, and that was the scientific part of it. That was the lesson for me, was the big difference between like 95 or 97% sun blockage. The sun is so bright that still is a lot of light, you know, as compared to 100%.
Sure.
Didn't realize that, boy.
Yeah.
The official BGSU page, shout out Bowling Green State University, they posted their watch party at Dwight Perry Stadium.
A bunch of people at the Dwight, yeah.
They were just going nuts there. That was fantastic. There are many other watch parties. One of the biggest ones was actually right on the lake in Avon Lake. There was, which was right underneath the path of totality. Obviously, Great Lakes Science Center had their big event, which had almost 16,000 people, yeah. I guess. So, you know, everything was just almost surreal. Again, with science and with many subjects, when you see stuff firsthand, it just blows your mind. And this definitely did for me.
Something that we're never going to see again in our lifetime.
Yeah, 29. Well, not in Ohio anyway. 2099 is what they're saying the next one's going to be. I mean, the next coast-to-coast situation like this one for an eclipse is going to be in 2045. That one starts in Northern California and goes like down toward Florida.
Hmm.
So, yeah, that's a long time even. That's 21 years. So.
Yeah, so, I mean, unless in the next 21 years we move to somewhere that's going to be in that line of sight, yeah, we're not going to see another totality. This is a solar eclipse, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was really cool to see. I got to be honest, in the lead up to it, I was like, yeah, well, who cares? When you sit and you look up and you got the glasses and you're looking up, and then for me, it started to get really, really cool and interesting. Like, first of all, the shadows that were being put off. Like, I have a here, let me pull this up. Obviously, I can show this to Steve. You guys can't see this. But, like, just some crazy shadows, like, on my back patio from the trees. And then just when it just started to just, like, get dark. And what was interesting is it looked like we had like a complete 360-degree sunset.
Yep.
Obviously, because, you know, the moon covering up the middle and then the, you know. But
the corona.
Yeah, that was the craziest part, was just watching like almost like a sunset happening at 3 o'clock, 3:15-ish in the afternoon, and then it lasting for 3 minutes, and then the sun rises again pretty much in another 3 minutes. It was just crazy.
Quite a moment, quite an unforgettable moment, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Kind of sort of bleeds into my neighborhood segment. My theme this week, this is actually sort of sad if you think about it, but this neighborhood is, if the sun was shining on all of Cleveland, this would be the neighborhood that was behind the dark side of the moon, where the sun just doesn't shine, basically. I'm talking about the neighborhood of Mount Pleasant. I sometimes call Mount Unpleasant. This neighborhood is bounded in the east by Shaker Heights, along Kinsman Road, which turns into Chagrin Road at the border. That's like between Menlo Road and East 149th. It's bordered on the north by Van Aken, Abel Avenue, and Imperial Avenue. In the west by East 110th Street, and then in the south by Corlett Avenue. More or less, if you look at it on a map, it's sort of rectangular, even though it has, you know, a little bit of odd jogs in it. Union Avenue and Kinsman Avenue are the two main roads that go east-west through this neighborhood. East 116th Street and East 131st Street are the two roads that go north-south. And I'll just say very quickly, this is not a place you want to travel into, pretty much. It's not an area that has, you know, much in the way for locals or tourists in terms of local businesses. It's mostly just all residential, and the residential areas are not all that nice. The average home price there is under $50,000. It's pretty impoverished. There's crime. It's not like super high on the violent crime rate compared to some of the other neighborhoods, particularly on the northeast side of town, but it's just, I don't know. It's just not great territory, to be honest. So sometimes you just have to call it for what it is. So that's Mount Pleasant. You can wham it with the right hand.
Shit, that was, wow. A nice abbreviated version.
Yeah. We got a lot to cover tonight. So sorry if you're... Oh.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's...
Didn't mean to interrupt you.
Nah, that's all right. Anyhow, we had a bit of a fascinating back and forth about the Cavs right before this episode started.
Well, yeah, that's because they stink.
Am I just not calling, you know, a spade here?
Or, yeah,
or
I don't know.
Just being negative. I don't know.
No, I don't know why. I don't understand. I don't know what there is to be positive about this team right now. Name something there is to be positive about this team.
They
currently,
won,
right now,
they won one game out of five on the West trip.
That's not positive.
That's all I have to go on right now.
Right. Exactly. My point. They stink.
Yeah, this past week stunk. They
No.
They lost to
LA
and
not
they lost
this, to the LA. Not this past week. The past 2 months they've stunk.
They were 3-1 the previous week.
They've stunk. They're like 5 games under 500 since the All-Star break. They're bad. They're really bad. And they're going to struggle to win a game in the playoffs, no matter who they play.
I think you're being a creature of the moment again, like you so often are, when you send texts like this game is over in the second quarter.
What moment? This has been 2 months.
I think you're just...
This isn't a moment. This is 2 months. And this is J.B. Bickerstaff's entire coaching tenure. He does this all the time, every year. He's horrible after the All-Star break every single year. And it's going to cost him his job this year.
Well, yeah, if they don't win a playoff series this year, he's probably not going to be bad.
Well, they're not going to, so.
Well, you seem really, really convinced on this. You said that you would make Orlando an almost 3x favorite against the Cavs in the first round, which to me is insane, seeing as Orlando wasn't even in the tournament a year ago.
Well, we were, and we won one game.
We got beat pretty badly by New York.
So what gives you this LeBron's not walking through that door. What gives you this confidence that we're just going to flip a switch and play well in the playoffs this year?
I didn't really say that, but they're not as bad as they're playing right now. We saw what their whole track record was for the first
four
months of the season.
I don't disagree.
Before injuries and harder opposition sort of just, you know, started to bring things back down to earth in late February and March.
Okay, but what's going to happen in the playoffs? You're going to play harder opposition.
I don't know that Orlando is harder opposition, or Indiana is harder opposition than they've had to play most of the games the last 2 months. I mean, you could look at the records and make that argument, but I don't know. It's just.
But more games than not in the last 2 months, they're losing. There's nothing positive about this team right now. Nothing. And I don't...
Currently struggling with Memphis, too, which is, like, even more disturbing because Memphis is a team that has absolutely nothing to play for down the stretch. I mean, I still think the Cavs are going to win this game semi-comfortably in the end, but it's a 3-point game in the third quarter. That's not good.
Yeah, I will be flabbergasted if we make it to the Eastern Conference semifinals.
That didn't even seem like a hard task for good portion of the season.
Well, when you're 5 games under 500 over the last 2 months, I mean, we talked about it before we even came on the show. There is a non-zero possibility that the Cavs might be in the play-in tournament.
They'd have to lose at least 2 of their last 3 games for that to happen, but yes, it is theoretically on the table. They're only a game and a half ahead of Philly coming into tonight. They're in 7th place. So,
yeah.
Just quickly going through the records here. Boston and Milwaukee have already clinched playoff spots. The Knicks at 47-32, they can clinch a playoff spot with another win or a loss by Philadelphia. The Magic and the Cavaliers are both 46-33. I believe the two teams split the season series 2-2, but they are giving the Magic the fourth seed. I'm not sure on what tie-breaking personnel, but Indiana is 46-34, half game behind, and then Philadelphia in seventh, 45-35. Oddly enough, the team that's been like hottest over the last few weeks, Miami, has hit the skids this week and are now down in the eighth.
Yeah.
So 44-35. So right now it is Philly and Miami in that those 7 and 8 spots and having to go through the play-in tournament, but that could change. You know, the onus is on the Cavs, the Magic, the Pacers to not let that happen to them, but it is possible. I said last week that even if the Cavs beat, maybe this is why I'm not as worried as you are. I sort of saw this coming, that the Cavs were going to have trouble out west. But then I said, this week they play 3 games. 2 of them are against bottom feeders. They're basically gimmies. We don't have anything to worry about. Is this a case of famous last words? Dan certainly thinks so.
Well, what do you mean by not anything to worry about? Like, I'm not worried that the Cavs are going to miss the playoffs. What I'm saying is we're not going to do anything once we get there.
I think
so. So why is the fact that, okay, we get to these easy teams who are not going to be in the playoffs, and if we beat them, oh, that just makes everything better and we feel better about the outlook of the team. I could care less about what happens these last 3 games of the year.
They just need a little bit of continuity and a little bit of confidence right now.
There's only 3 games left. You can't get continuity in 3 games.
Going in on 2 or 3 game win streak, that makes you feel better than, you know, losing 4 or 5 or, you know, losing 8 of 11 or whatever they did before that, you know.
I don't know. I don't think there's anything to there isn't any realistic reason to have real confidence about this basketball team right now.
Well, I mean, I respect that opinion. I mean,
and
it's honestly not a terrible opinion based on how they've played.
And we are staring potentially seismic changes in the offseason with this club. You're probably going to have a new head coach. I find it extremely hard to believe that Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland will be back on this team next year. One of those two guys will be gone. I just don't think you're going to bring both of those guys back.
I think Mitchell's going to be gone.
I've said
that for a while.
If that's the case, we are in deep trouble.
I wish I didn't have that opinion, but I felt that way from
Well, I mean, we'll see, because the Cavs are obviously going to offer him a max contract, and if he turns him down, then yeah, they're going to trade him. I mean, they're not just going to let him walk for nothing.
No.
So, you know, and to be honest with you, if the doomsday scenario that I think might happen and the Cavs just limp into the playoffs and just get absolutely blasted like they did last year, I don't know that Kobe Altman's job is safe. Remember, Dan Gilbert is the owner. Gilbert is the owner of the basketball team. You have to remember that.
That's a reason to not root for that, because we lose Kobe Altman too. I would be legitimately fearful for the future of this franchise. I really would be.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. But you know, I don't know. He's been here. He's been our GM / team president for how long? And what have we done with him? We've won 1 playoff game. I don't count the last LeBron year when David Griffin left. But whatever. I'm just saying that doomsday scenario is out there, and the way that this team is playing right now, you know, if they go out and they get gentlemanly swept by Orlando and lose in 5, that's 2 straight years they've lost in the first round in 5 games.
I would be super, super disappointed if that's what ended up happening. Just because of maybe it's because of the nature of the opponent. Same thing with Indiana. Like, if it was them too, they weren't in the playoffs last year either. Like, that would really annoy me. Like, if it's a team like, say, Milwaukee or Miami, who actually has a decent track record and has been winning playoff games and even championships in recent times, to me it's not as big of a deal. But if you come on with a team that wasn't even there a year ago, it goes to show you that the progression that you should have had as a franchise was just completely usurped. It's no longer there, and
and
that gives you the impetus to just blow it up.
Okay, but we were barely there last year. So we won 1 game in a first round playoff series where we were the heavy favorites and had home court advantage. Is that really that big of a difference?
The opponent to me matters. I guess maybe it doesn't matter so much to you.
No, you lose in the first round, you lose in the first round. I don't care who it is.
Okay.
Like, honestly, I would feel worse if we played the Knicks again and lost in the exact same manner as we did last year. That would actually make me feel worse.
Well, then you should definitely root for the Knicks not to fall to fourth and the Cavs to stay in fifth, because that is far more likely, I think, than if we play Indiana or Orlando. But I've had that opinion for a while now. I'm not coming off of it.
We'll see. The Cavs stink right now, so anything's in play, my opinion. But
boy, the tone of this show has been kind of bad for the last, like, 10 minutes or so. What are we going to do here?
I mean, I don't know. We can talk about the Cavs some more.
Do we really?
I don't really want to.
No, I don't either.
So I could say we could talk about baseball again, but the Guardians are... Oh, they did tie the game. The Guardians have been down 5-0 early in the last two nights, and they've battled back to tie it. The problem is it looks like they're on the verge of giving it up again, because the White Sox have runners on the corners and nobody out in the top of the ninth.
Guardians are getting out hit 9-5. That's pretty good efficiency. The Guardians have 5 runs on 5 hits.
3 home runs. The brothers Naylor hit home runs in the fourth inning, and then Stephen Kwan brought them back within 1 in the fifth, and then David Fry got hit by a pitch with the bases loaded to tie the game. But the White Sox have runners on the corners with nobody out, so that would be a bad loss.
Yeah, this would be really bad if the Guardians don't win the series, because that would mean they'd lose the series outright at home to Chicago. That would not be good. Chicago is not a good
Chicago's
team.
Chicago's horrible.
This was a series that, like, we were talking about it, like, Oakland and Chicago getting them early got to build up some, you know, good records. And luckily, the Guardians took care of business against Seattle and Minnesota. If we go back to the beginning of the week, you know, they took two games in Minnesota. The third game got rained out. They didn't play on Sunday. Then they came home, beat the White Sox pretty convincingly in the home opener on Monday. And then for whatever reason, the starting pitching just hasn't had it at the beginning of these games against Chicago the last two nights. You know, I guess you're going to go through some periods of that. But again, with the way the Guardians typically don't hit, that's a big problem, but it is a credit to them, like you said, that they were down 5-0, actually did battle back to tie the game yesterday. They did the same thing today. You know, it just goes to show you just can't put yourself in that kind of a hole with any sort of consistency and actually hope to win.
Yeah. All right. Let's see here.
Guardians right now are 8-3 on the season coming into
tonight. 8-3. Got the absolute red-hot Yankees coming into town this weekend, which I was hoping to be able to go on Friday. My birthday's on Saturday. I was hoping to go on Friday, but that's not looking likely.
Don't know if we'll even get the game in on Friday.
They're going to have to try and play a doubleheader the next day because this is the Yankees' only trip to Progressive Field this year. So they're going to have to try and get 3 games in this weekend. I don't know how they're going to do it, but, you know, they will do it.
The White Sox, by the way, are 2-9, worst team in the American League.
They're 1-8 coming to Cleveland.
Even worse than Oakland, who are now 4-7, oddly enough.
Yeah, they've won a couple in a row here. But, all right.
Looking out league-wide just really quickly here, the best teams out there right now, the Dodgers are 10-5. The Pirates are 9-3, leading the NL Central. The Braves are 7-3, leading the NL East. The Yankees, you mentioned, 10-2 atop the AL East. And there's really nobody playing well in the AL West right now. The Rangers are 6-5 in first place. The Astros are actually 4-8. They're actually looking up at the Athletics in the standings. That's hilarious.
The Astros, I'm pretty sure every single starting pitcher on the Astros opening day roster is now hurt.
World's smallest violin.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, a lot to shake out still. Obviously, we're just over 1/15 into the season, so you know we'll a lot still to shake out in baseball. Obviously, even if the Guardians lose today, that'll be 8-4. They're not going to play at that clip the whole year. Nobody does, but yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens.
So right now, I gotta ask this question: if we're talking about this year, 2024,
yeah,
which team has a better chance of winning a playoff series, Guardians or Cavs?
Well, the Cavs, because they're going to be in the playoffs.
Okay, so you're not convinced based on the strong start that the Guardians will be there yet.
I mean, they could be, but the Cavs literally are going to be in the playoffs. That's basically a certainty. Like, the Guardians, the Guardians could either be 15 games above 500 in June, they could be 15 games below 500 in June. I mean, we don't know. Hmm. I'll say this, if you guaranteed me both teams were in the playoffs, I'd tell you the Guardians.
Okay, so you think the getting there part is harder?
That's the key.
Whereas if they get there, they might like play loose and like they did in 2022 and you know, knock out the Rays and before they took the Yankees to five games. Mm. Okay.
Yeah. I think the pressure of the world is on the Cavaliers right now, and they're not handling it well.
That's actually I greatly respect that take. I do think that to some degree the bad trajectory of the last 2 months of last year is wearing on them right now. I do agree with that.
And they just to update, end of the third quarter, they have opened up a double digit lead on Memphis, so it's looking like they're going to get that win tonight. So, but I mean, whatever.
Kind of what I figured was going to happen, but
doesn't really mean
78-67 is the score right now. But who are we kidding here? The last week, the emphasis in the sports world was actually here on Cleveland to a large extent. But this week, it's not going to be here. It is instead going to be on one Augusta, Georgia.
Talk about a good iron. Stupid freaking ad.
They'll get you.
God. Mother bleeping.
Is this also a tradition unlike any other?
Ah. Hello, friends. And welcome to another edition of LOTL Previews the Masters. From the beautiful landscape of Augusta National in Augusta, Georgia, by way of Parma Heights, Ohio, we give you the 2024 Masters.
I got my $3 tuna salad sandwich right next to
me. Tuna? They have tuna there?
I'm just guessing.
It's pimento cheese, egg salad, and barbecue are the three main sandwiches.
Ah.
All, I believe, are $1.50, which is crazy. How they just keep the prices.
That sounds even better with today's
inflation. What I can't believe I don't have right now is a ice-cold Arnold Palmer. That should have been my beer of the week this week. But anyway, just cannot wait to hear Jim Nance on the weekend. He doesn't do Thursday and Friday, does he?
No, that's ESPN.
That's right. But Jim Nance. Hello, friends. What year of the Masters is this? Do you know?
Oh, boy. I mean, they've been playing it since the 1930s, I know at least. It's getting up close to 100 years if it isn't already.
See if I quick Google search.
Greatest shot in the history of the Masters was in 1935. Gene Sarazen's Albatross on the 15th.
Are we sure about that? I disagree with you.
L. Tiggs chip on 2005.
Yep. Was that 5 or 6? 2005 or 6? I can't remember. Was it 2005?
I don't know. It was one of those 2 years.
That's 2005 or 2006. Yeah. That's the great. That the magnitude of that shot. That's the greatest, in my opinion. It was a chip. It's not like, okay, an albatross is great. A hole in one is better. But the way he had to chip that to get that to go in, I mean, find me a better golf shot.
It is hard to compare the two moments because none of us were alive in 1935.
True.
But they were both in the last round, both within the last four holes. So we'll just call it even, I guess.
Yeah.
But there's no doubting what an incredible moment that was. And, like, Nike couldn't have, like, if they put that on a soundstage, Nike couldn't have even had it any better than that because it was, like, literally showing the logo of the ball as it stopped right next to the hole for a split second and then went in.
Yeah. I can't wait. I've said it. We've done this. Yeah. Yeah.
In your life, have you ever seen anything like that?
Yeah, it is without a doubt. I've done this podcast. I've been doing this podcast now with you for 2 years. Done this podcast for 5 years now. Coming up, literally, it's been 5 years. I think end of March is when we started this in 2018. 6 years.
Six.
Holy mackerel.
Six.
For 6 years, I have said the same thing. That my favorite sports event of the entire year. And obviously, maybe I'm biased because I love golf, and this tournament is usually one of the days either happens on my birthday or is right around if my birthday is early in the week. It's the Masters, particularly the back nine on Sunday when there are multiple guys within a stroke or two of each other just battling it out for the coveted green jacket. For me, there is absolutely nothing better in sports. So I'm hoping we get to see that again. There are a lot of guys in the field that I think can win. We're going to go over that, actually. But first, I wanted to ask you, there are a ton of famed holes on this golf course. What is your favorite hole at Augusta National?
You know,
favorite hole to watch, and this might be the same one. Favorite hole to watch, and obviously neither of us have played Augusta. Fat chance either of us probably ever get to, but favorite hole to watch people play, and favorite hole you think would be your favorite to play.
Well, my favorite hole to play would almost certainly be the par three on Amen Corner. Is that 12?
12, yeah.
Yes.
With the bean green.
Yeah.
Green looks like a bean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one where it's like you have to be so incredibly precise to even just get it on the plateau.
Yep.
And then even if you like put it in the grass behind, you could flub the chip and end up in the water on the second shot. So like that would be a really cool one to play, without a doubt. To watch, I'm actually going to go to 18.
Okay, the finishing hole.
18 has one of the narrowest
shoots
out from the tee box ever seen, with how tight the trees are. Like, for me, I'd probably have to hit 3-wood off the tee on a day where I'm slicing it bad, I may even have to hit iron because there's no way I could hit driver. I just have too much, you know, fade movement on the ball to even
too much banana spin doil.
Yep. So it's like you go through that, and then the second shot is mostly blind uphill to the green, you know, which is pretty well protected by bunkers. It's a great finishing hole, honestly.
Oh, absolutely.
And adds to a lot of theater, particularly, I mean, God forbid, if it's like within a shot, like going to the last hole. Oh, oh my gosh.
There's nothing better. A return to glory. Mm-hmm. The famous Jim Nantz call of Tiger Woods' 2019 win. Yeah, just for me, my favorite hole to watch and probably my favorite to play will be 16.
Okay.
There've just been so many iconic moments on 16 over the years. Not just Tiger's chip, there have been plenty of aces on 16. At 16 there's two holes after it, but I feel like a lot of times because it's a par three, because there's water there, like that hole a lot of times wins the golf tournament on Sunday, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean 12 and 16, the other two par threes.
Yeah,
you know it's one of those like you hit a good shot, you could easily birdie. If you hit a bad one, it could end up being bogey or double bogey. You could be done.
Yeah, 12 is like the setup. 12 is like when you get once you get to the back nine on Sunday, you get to 12. It's like okay. If everybody's within a stroke or two of each other, like not everybody, but I'm talking like 3, 4, 5 guys that have a legit chance to win. If you birdie 12 on Sunday and you're in that position, you are in a great spot to kind of run down the rest of the holes and potentially try and win the thing. Consequently, you could also chunk your tee shot on 12 and end up in the water, but.
Yeah.
Or you can end up in the front side bunker, just trying to fly it over and land it on that skinny green. But yeah, 16.
The pin placement that they put it in on Sunday on 16 behind the lake is like, if you put it into the area just off to the right, maybe about 20 feet, it just rolls right down toward the hole. And that's where you talk about holes in one. That's where how the majority of them have happened there.
Yeah, at 16, you're not aiming for the pin. You're aiming about 25 feet past the pin and, like you said, to the right.
Mm-hmm.
You do that thing is funneling back. And it's going to end up right next to the hole. Tiger actually almost holed out in 2019, doing almost the exact same thing he did on his chip, where he landed it about 25 feet past the hole, and it just the between the slope of the green and the backswing he put on the ball, it just rolled right up next to it and rolled, I think, about 2 feet past to the right where you're looking at it, to the left where he is at the tee box. But just a fantastic. Just a fantastic hole. I love 18 too, obviously. I feel like a lot of times with the Masters, especially in recent years, 18 is almost like a coronation hole. It's like, okay, we pretty much know who the winner's going to be. He's either got like a two-shot lead like going to 18. So unless he does what you say and slices the crap out of his tee shot and ends up in the trees, you pretty much, as long as you get through that tee box and that tee shot, you're basically walking up the fairway tipping your cap to the crowd because they're just giving you a standing ovation as mm-hmm. you're walking up. I know that was the case with Rahm last year. Who won it the year before? I think Scottie Scheffler won it the year before. But, it's going to be – and another thing, what's interesting, and I want to get to some of the odds and just kind of talk about who we like as far as winning the tournament. Let's see. What's interesting is, you know, Scottie Scheffler is the runaway favorite,
deservedly should be.
According to DraftKings, he is plus 400, the outright winner. Second is Rory McIlroy at plus 1,000. So Scottie is up there. The interesting thing, though, it be wary about betting Scottie because he said his wife is due to give birth any day now. And he says if she goes into labor during the tournament, he's withdrawing immediately. So be wary about betting Scottie Scheffler to win the tournament. I would also be wary on him, you know, any of the top 10, top 20 finishes that you can bet on as well. Because what happens if he's through six holes on Thursday and he gets the call that his wife goes into labor? He's done. He's withdrawing from the tournament.
Scottie Scheffler should know better than to end up in a situation like this.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
You got to have better timing, my man.
That certainly is an argument. let's see. So we got Rory McIlroy at plus 1,000. John Rahm is plus 1,100, the defending champion. That's a juicy bet right there. Although Rahm is the latest defectee to LIV Golf. He's been playing 54-hole tournaments and in shorts over the last several months. Is he really going to be in the frame of mind to be winning the Masters? I guess Koepka did it. He didn't do it at the Masters last year, but he did win. What did Koepka win last year? Was that the USA Open or the U.S. Open? Or was it the British Open?
Jeez. He's won the U.S. Open before. I just don't know if it was last year.
He won a major last year. PGA, actually. I named every single one but the one he won. So we shall see what happens. Obviously, if Koepka's healthy, he's always going to be in it, no matter what. Is there anyone that maybe has some long odds that pops out to you that you're looking at?
Well, I could be snarky and say Angel Cabrera, but like he was unable to get back in the country for this event. So.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, his visa request got denied. But, as far as, you know, folks that, you know, you're not really thinking of, before I even get to that, I wanted to talk a little bit about this whole thing. You mentioned LIV and PGA and how, you know, they had the Masters welcome dinner yesterday, and
yeah.
You know they feasted on Basque ribeye steak and paella and
John
a whole
Rahm.
Bunch of other Spanish fare. Yeah, that sign me up for that. I would have loved to be there for that. Spain has some of the most delectable food in the entire world. I studied abroad there back in 2008. Thank goodness I did, because that was fantastic. But anyhow, like. These LIV guys have proven that they can actually still win the majors, even though they're playing these tournaments, as you say, which are not full-length tournaments like the PGA. They're playing a little bit less regularly than most guys are on the PGA. It's actually been a little bit of a controversial thing because LIV events are not considered for the official world golf rankings, and that's caused a lot of people to be, you know, unhappy about the whole situation. there's talks between the PGA and the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia about what a merged LIV and PGA would look like. You know, would there be more of the so-called team events, more match play events, perhaps? But it's something that they're still working on. But in the meantime, this is one of the few times where you actually do get to see the PGA guys and the LIV guys really truly go at it. Because some of the other majors, it's harder for the LIV guys to get into. The Masters, they don't care. They'll just invite people no matter what. Like,
right.
They're just like, you know, they want Phil Mickelson in it. They want, well, obviously he's won it before, so he'll be in it regardless. They want Bryson DeChambeau in it. They want Jon Rahm in it. They want these, you know, other Louis Oosthuizen and, you know, some of these guys. So, you know, this is, I think now, because for a long time, I always considered the U.S. Open to be the biggest tournament of the year. I'm now starting to lean toward the Masters just because of this whole thing between PGA and LIV, because, you know, the USGA hasn't been as welcoming to the LIV players as Augusta National has. This is, in a lot of respects, the one truly open tournament out there, like the best of the best, literally. Yeah. It's almost like, you know, I mean, now the Olympics, I mean, they have golf in the Olympics now, obviously, so that's a legit world championship. But, like, this is the one that happens every year on the same course and has all the best players in it guaranteed.
Yeah.
So, like, it just is what it is. It's just great. It's great theater. Love it.
Yeah, definitely. Real quick, I want to go back to let me see.
I didn't really answer your question through all that, but one guy that I think, for whatever reason, I may have just have a liking for this guy. A guy that I, when you talk about dark horses, I don't even know if you can call him a dark horse at plus 1,400. That's Xander Schauffele.
Yeah.
I've always been a big fan of his game.
Yep.
It seems like he's one of those guys who he may not win, but he seems to always be in the hunt in a lot of the big events. Guy played, my recollection, really well at the last Ryder Cup. You know, I think he's got as good a shot as anybody, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I like Xander too. He's a guy that it seems like every single major he's, you know, he has not won a major, I don't think.
He has
yet.
Not.
But he's still a very young guy, and he always seems to be in the thick of it. My dark horse guy is at plus 4,000. That's Wyndham Clark.
Okay.
Wyndham Clark has been playing really, really well. And the thing that I always like to look at as we get to a major championship is how a guy has played in the two or three tournaments previous. Now, obviously, that's not an exact science because they're playing on different courses. Like, it's not exact. Like, Augusta is a very, very, very specific course that gets played every year for this tournament. So it is kind of hard to be like, oh, well, you know, Wyndham Clark won here or he played really well here. Well, it's not the same course, but momentum is certainly a thing in all sports and especially golf. Like especially on the green, if you are putting well going into a major tournament, that is almost the biggest indicator of success for that major championship is how you're rolling the flat stick. And
yep.
I just think Wyndham Clark is playing really well. And I mean, plus 4,000. I mean, you just put a $5 bet on that, and then he wins. You win $80. Or not $80. No, plus 4,000 would be plus 200. You'd win $200.
$200.
I sold myself short. But anyway.
So,
to
your point about putting, to me, the majors really boil down to two sticks, the putter and the driver. If you are hitting fairways and you are hitting, well, I mean, hitting greens is important too, but that'd be your in-between clubs. If you're making putts and you're hitting fairways, you're giving yourself a heck of a lot of chances to score.
Yeah.
And you're also keeping yourself out of trouble, generally speaking, as well. If I had to pick, we'll go back, you know, if you're talking about dark horses, if I had to pick somebody that's not in the top 10 in the odds,
yep,
that I think really has a good shot, I would say Will Zalatoris at plus 4,000.
Look, you and I are speaking the same language.
I've really liked his game for a long while now too. He's one of those guys that, you know, tends to, you know, he could either be completely out of it or he could be winning.
Yeah.
He's the opposite of Xander Schauffele, who's
yeah.
like a lot in the hunt but never seems to win. This guy's totally separate, cuz like last year he won like two or three tour events in a row all of a sudden, and like he didn't do much else the rest of the year.
Yeah.
You know, so he's one of those catch lightning in a bottle type guys, you know.
Any desire to throw a couple bucks on Tiger at plus 14,000?
No.
Listen, I don't laugh.
I'd rather play the Mega Millions than
do
that.
I don't laugh because I don't like Tiger. Quite frankly, I would love for Tiger to be in the hunt on Sunday. I just hope he can make the cut, and that has nothing to do with how he is as a player, obviously. He's one of the greatest of all time. But he's like, what, 47 years old now? And he, after the accident he had where he almost lost his leg, he can barely walk. Like, I have a hard time believing he's going to be able to walk 72 holes in 4 days. And again, that's not making fun. He limps. He has a constant limp all the time now because of that injury that he suffered a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we said he was never going to be the same, and he obviously is not. But I think it would be great if he could just make the cut. You know, he's the one thing about Tiger, he has literally never missed a cut at Augusta. Never.
That's pretty incredible when you think about it. The times he's played there.
I believe he's 24 for 24 in Masters or something like that. I know he's never missed a cut. I just don't know the exact amount of Masters tournaments he's played. Now, obviously, he missed a few Masters tournaments due to injury and everything that he went through in the early 2010s. But, I personally think you're throwing your money away if you put any money on him to win. I don't think it's going to – he even said it today. He was asked, do you feel like you can win this week? And he said, if everything breaks my way, yes. Well –
that's a long way from the golf course looks good, the golf swing feels good, I like my chances.
Right. Well, yeah, when he was 31 years old and, you know, was literally beating everybody every single week. Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, so. Just
quickly going through a couple of the other names we haven't mentioned that are in the top 20 in the odds.
Yeah.
Brooks Koepka, well, we did mention his name.
Yep.
Hideki Matsuyama, another former champion. Jordan Spieth.
Yep. Man, Jordan Spieth at plus 2,500.
Bryson DeChambeau, Victor Hovland, Patrick Cantlay,
yep.
Cameron Smith, Dustin Johnson,
yep.
and Justin Thomas, and Tony Finau are all plus 4,000 or under to win this
Tommy game. Fleetwood as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
I feel like, and maybe this is just recency bias of this weekend, I feel like there are more guys looking at this list, and the list is almost the exact same as it was last year, so this is obviously recency bias, but because I have the list in front of me. I feel like there's more names that I could be like, yep, I could see him winning. 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 By the way, the Guardians won in 10 innings, 7-5 over the White Sox.
So the White Sox put runners on the corners with nobody
did
out
not
and didn't
score.
Yep. Sucks
and
to suck.
And the Cavs are going to win, too. Looks like by about 15. So
winning.
So all in all, a good night for Cleveland sports.
Can we be positive now for a little bit? Because it was really negative earlier on.
If you're talking about the Cavs, no.
Even the Guardians are like, the Guardians are about to give up the lead.
It's the Grizzlies. It's the Grizzlies at home. Like, it's there's. No, I'm not going to be.
They should win that game. They did win that game, thankfully.
Yeah. Oh, actually, it was 7-6. So, So I read it wrong. 7-6. So the White Sox.
The White Sox did score.
Yeah.
And then
so
the Guardians
had
to come back and win
extras.
The bottom of the 10th.
Yeah.
Or 9th. Excuse me.
I wonder how they did it. Let's see.
Did you say it was in 10 or was it
10? Yeah.
Oh, so it wasn't 10. So it was like White Sox scored one in the 9th, then the Guardians came back and scored one after that, and then they probably scored one in the 10th as well. Unless the White Sox really didn't score in the 9th.
White Sox scored in the 10th, and we scored twice in the 10th.
Oh, so they did not score in the 9th. Oh, boy. And then they scored one in the 10th, and the Guardians came back and scored two in the bottom.
Yep.
There's not a more demoralizing way to lose in baseball than that.
White Sox got a double in the 10th inning, which scored the automatic runner on second. And then the Guardians did the exact same thing in the 10th inning. The Naylor brothers again. Josh Naylor doubled to center. Andrés Giménez scored. And then Bo Naylor, single to the right, brings home the winning run. So the Naylor brothers in the 10th inning winning the game. How about that? On National Siblings Day. Shout out to my brothers.
Okay.
I know you probably want to shout out your brother.
Yeah. Hey, Matthew.
Yeah.
How you doing?
Yeah, so that's interesting. Nice little sidebar there. So, Cleveland team's winning. But by the time you're listening to this, you already know that. Yeah, I want to go over a couple other bets and a couple bets that I've actually placed for the Masters. I want to get your opinion on. Let's see here. So I have
over under on holes and one on 16.
No.
Oh, rats! I was hoping that would be up there.
So I have a top 10, top 20, top 40 parlay.
Oh, okay.
Wyndham Clark to finish in the top 40.
Okay.
John Rahm to finish in the top 20.
I like both of those to cash.
And Xander Schauffele to finish in the top 10.
I like that one to cash, too.
That one off at plus 332. So I placed that one.
Okay.
That was a two-unit bet, so I'm feeling good about that one.
All right.
And then here's another parlay, a top 20 parlay. I've got Koepka, Zalatoris, and Max Homa all to finish in the top 20.
Not quite as sure about Max Homa, but that sounds very doable. If he's in the top 20, I'm pretty sure you'll get the other two in the top 20.
I played that one just based solely on the odds. The odds of that is plus 755.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So those are my two Masters bets so far. I'm going to place a bet on a winner. I just have not placed that yet. So if you were given the odds that we looked at, and you mentioned a couple names that you liked, if you had to pick one and factor in the odds, who are you betting on to win the Masters?
It would be Xander Schauffele.
Oh, really?
I just have that feeling that it's his time. I don't know why. I think he's been knocking on the door for a long while, and I don't know. Why not now?
He was, what were his odds? Was he one of the plus 4,000 boys?
He was plus 1,400. Fourth best odds on the board.
Wow, Ryan, really?
Rahm, okay. McIlroy, and Scheffler.
Scheffler, yeah. Scheffler would be the easy pick, but man, that whole thing about his wife going into labor and him just withdraw, which obviously, not going to blame him
for withdrawing
if his wife goes into labor. But yeah, that's just a wild card, man. Like obviously, if it was Scottie Scheffler and everything was hunky-dory, I mean, your wife being pregnant and about to go into labor is hunky-dory. Like, that's the best moment of your life. But if there weren't any outside factors, I mean, you have to put it on Scheffler. He's far and away the best golfer in the world right now.
You know what would actually make this whole thing, like, even... Like, if he's going to win and this whole thing, you know, the baby is coming.
Yep.
Imagine, like, Scheffler just has one of those weeks where he's just unstoppable.
Just unconscionable.
And he's up, like, by six or eight shots, like going to Amen Corner.
Yeah.
And then we find out, like, as he's on the tee box on 12,
yeah,
we get the news that she's going into labor right then and there.
Man.
You know, that's like, well, you know, it becomes almost the side story as you get to the end of the round. Obviously, he would play it out at that point, but, like, you know.
Yeah. It would be great? It would obviously be great, but would also suck is if you were, like, let's say you're in second.
Yeah.
And you were the guy that was eight strokes behind Scheffler, and he withdraws, and you go on to win. Like, yeah, you win. You win a green jacket.
Oh, that would be weird.
You get all the perks. But nobody's going to say you're the actual Masters champ that year. You're down by eight strokes with six holes to play.
Right.
Like, come on.
Even that person.
Like, imagine if it was Brooks. I think he has like five majors now.
Yeah.
He's never won the Masters. But you imagine if this is the year he wins the Masters and that scenario plays out? Like, you won, but did you really win? Like, Scotty was going to beat you. Could you imagine?
He'd probably go to Scotty and be like, dude, and just FaceTime your wife right now. No, seriously, if you drop out, I'm dropping out too, because, like, that's ridiculous.
And Brooks is known as kind of curt anyway, and kind of like a, you know, I don't know, not a sourpuss, but he.
No, I mean that's what's been.
He's kind of like a throwing. Yeah, he's
kind of like Patrick Reed.
Kind of a prima donna type guy.
Yeah.
So you could just imagine how like reporters like asking him like, Like, yeah, you're the Masters champion, but are you really the Masters champion?
Yeah, no, did you really win the Dream Jack?
That would. I mean, obviously, like, yeah, you get to enjoy the perks of being a Masters champion the rest of your life, but are you really a Masters champion? So yeah, that would. Obviously, that would be great for Scotty. You know, at any time he gets to call that his wife's in labor, that's fantastic. But yeah, that would obviously make the finishing of the tournament a little weird.
He would get the 18. You know, let's say he just plays out the last few holes. He, you know, putts in whatever, and he like turns in the scorecard. He's like, guys, just mail me the green jacket. Like,
yeah.
I got bigger fish to fry.
Right. Exactly.
But no, that's great. Yeah, we've a lot of fun scenarios that could happen at this tournament. You know. But anyhow, that's going on this weekend, starting Thursday through Sunday. Dan's birthday, of course, Saturday, moving day of the tournament.
That's right.
Yeah. You know.
Yep, that is right. Hopefully, on Saturday, all of my bets move in the right direction. But yeah.
Interestingly enough, CBS Sports, in their roundup of this tournament, they said the star who definitely won't win is Victor Hovland.
Really?
Yeah. They said the full swing isn't there and the short game isn't there. I'm no rocket scientist, but that doesn't sound like a great combination. Hovland is yet to crack the top 10 this season and ranks 183rd in strokes gained around the green out of 183 players.
Yeah,
his streak of five straight major top 20s is going to end this week. Wow, that is scathing.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. If you are going into the Masters and you're not putting well, you have no chance. I mean, that goes for pretty much any tournament, but especially at the Masters. You have no chance if you're not putting well.
I mean, you basically have to be hitting every fairway and hitting every green, pretty much.
Yeah, every fairway, green, and reg.
And nobody does that.
No. The only guy that was doing that was Tiger in, like, between the years 2000 and 2006.
1997.
Yeah.
When he, by, like, 12.
Yeah, exactly. When he set the record. Yeah.
When he was still a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, so. But yeah, so that is the Masters. I hope everybody enjoys it. Even if you're not a golf fan, you're sitting there Sunday. You got the Sunday scaries staring at you right in the face. Work on Mondays coming up. Flip on CBS. It is just absolutely fantastic watching. I hope there's about five or six guys in contention on the back nine on Sunday. That would be drama. It would be incredible. So, anyway, we got any other news tonight?
So, on the heels of the NCAA Women's Final Four in Cleveland, which saw every game sold out, which saw over 20,000 people attend the Tourneytown Fan Fest at the Huntington Convention Center, which saw ticket prices going for literally four figures for the championship game on Sunday, it was just a total the perfect ending to the perfect season for NCAA women's basketball, and it gave such a statement of the fact that Cleveland supports women's sports to the extent that we do. I want to turn the attention to the ongoing push to try to get a franchise in the National Women's Soccer League, the NWSL, here in Cleveland. This has been going on for a while now. A group called Cleveland Pro Soccer has been working on this bid for several years now. And just to bring you up to speed, the NWSL prior to this year had 14 teams in it, or excuse me, had 12 teams in it. Two new teams just joined the league, San Francisco and Utah, bringing the league up to 14. So in the last expansion, they had two teams in the West. This time they're pointing to the East. They want two teams in the East to balance it out up at 16. That'll be the next expansion, which is going to happen in 2026. So this group has been, and this group actually has done their homework. They actually landed an MLS Next club that is supposed to start play in 2025.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of their vision, along with trying to get a team for the NWSL. Because one thing that we don't have compared to some of the other cities that are bidding, places like Nashville, places like Charlotte, and a couple others are in the running. We don't have a stadium. And part of their bid is to actually build a soccer-specific facility here in Cleveland. for both the MLS Next team and also the NWS, the NWSL team as well. That news is actually supposed to come fairly soon, like by the end of May or so. They're supposed to reveal some of the details, the renderings, and where they're thinking. The same place where we were talking about Brown's potential stadium site, that spot along Orange Avenue, Ontario Street, near the post office, they're looking at that spot too. We don't know exactly what they're going to decide to do. They could actually build out in the suburbs, but that's less good, of course.
It could go in that the plot of land that the Browns supposedly have bought is a lot bigger than what you need for a football stadium. There could be more than one structure being built there.
It would not be a stretch to think that Cleveland Pro Soccer could be working with the Haslams on something like that.
Oh, yeah.
So just to, you know, the momentum that we saw from the Final Four going in toward this, it's a different sport, obviously. But I think it does speak volumes about what the market is here in Cleveland for something like this. It was always going to be a somewhat difficult sell because naturally I don't believe there are any NWSL franchises in any city. Well, there's one that doesn't have an MLS team, and that is Racing Louisville in Louisville, Kentucky. So it is theoretically possible. And, you know, powerhouse. So some of the recent News 5 article says that I would say within the past 3 years, it's caught my attention. It's obviously getting more popular. The support was always there, finally getting recognition they deserve. We've had some amazing, you know, I lost the page there for a second. Cleveland Soccer Group, which is another organization that's helped with this effort, they're hoping that the building excitement around basketball translates to other women's sports, namely women's professional soccer. Their CSG co-founder and CEO Michael Murphy said, "We're absolutely at the point right now where we're going to see significant growth continue." He personally attended the Final Four events with his daughters and said it's clear there's an appetite for women's sports in Cleveland. "What's happened here this past weekend was incredible, but what we aim to do is create this sustainable piece for Cleveland's economy for many decades to come, not just the economy, but the sporting tradition as well." And as it stands right now, Boston more or less is guaranteed to get the 15th franchise. NWSL Commissioner Jessica Berman has pretty much all but said that in her comments. So it really is coming down. The consensus is that it's basically down between four cities to see who gets franchise 16: Cleveland, Indianapolis, Charlotte, and Nashville. And when you look at the facilities and the amenities of these cities, they're all kind of similar in the respect that their downtowns are all pretty compact. That all the main sites that you'd want to see are in a pretty small area. And if you have a facility right in that core, which Nashville, Indianapolis, and Charlotte do, Charlotte, it's a little bit disingenuous to say because Charlotte FC plays at Bank of America Stadium where the Panthers are, so they don't have a soccer specific facility in Charlotte. But you know, it's a situation kind of like in Atlanta and Seattle where the MLS team just plays in the NFL stadium. But we're right in this mix. And I do think that even if for whatever reason they don't pick Cleveland, they pick one of the other cities, I think Indy might actually have the best claim out of all of them, because there's only two teams in the Midwest out of 14 right now. You've got Chicago Red Stars and Kansas City Current. There's no one else there. So I really do. And you look at it geographically speaking, there's no teams even close to Cleveland. Louisville is the next closest, and that's just, it's a little disingenuous to say that's anywhere near our market. So geographically, it makes sense. In terms of the market size, in terms of the economy, in terms of the fan support, it makes sense. The biggest hurdle to this whole effort is the stadium. We should get some news on that within the next month, maybe 2 months. And we're going to see how this plays out. And again, I think if we're not picked, I do think there is a good chance that when they do a further expansion later, again, you can see where this league is going. It's kind of in the same progression mode as the MLS. The MLS debuted with, I think it was 8 teams at the beginning, and it went up and up for a while, but then they had some growing pains and a few teams, you know, didn't make it, like Tampa Bay Mutiny and Miami Fusion. But then after that, you know, the league kind of just became more established, and then eventually it was just a whole growth pattern. The NWSL in the last couple of years, you know, they had a few teams go away. Boston Breakers went away. Why they're going back to Boston after that, I don't know, but that's the Western New York Flash went away. You know, that was unfortunate. But so they're kind of through the growing pains phase that the MLS went through in the early 2000s, you know, 6-7 years into their life cycle. The NWSL has just come through that now. They're now on a path where it really does look like they are poised to capitalize on what is legitimately a women's sports revolution that is just starting, which started with the in women's basketball. But also, I have to point out that Kansas City Current, which is one of the franchises I mentioned earlier, they were the first team to actually build their own stadium facility. And it was kind of a weird situation because there is an MLS franchise in Kansas City, Sporting Kansas City. For whatever reason, there was a falling out between the ownership of Sporting Kansas City and Kansas City Current, and Sporting Kansas City wouldn't let Current play there anymore at Children's Mercy Park anymore, the home of the Sporting Kansas City. So what they do, they went and built their own facility. It opened this year, and on NWSL opening day, Kansas City Current played Portland Thorns, the defending NWSL champion, and they sold the place out, and it was on national television. Game that drew about 10.5 million viewers. That's far higher than a typical MLS broadcast, or at least was before they went over to Apple TV. Now you can't even really measure what the ratings are anymore.
Yep.
But it just goes to show again that this is the beginning of something huge, and Cleveland is now has made their case to be a part of this. How it's going to play out from here, who knows? But that is what Cleveland Pro Soccer and Cleveland Soccer Group are trying to bring to the land. And we will be very happy to see it. And before we go, I do have to mention Columbus Crew again because their second leg tie with Tigres Monterrey last night went 1-1 through normal time and extra time and went to penalty kicks. We talk about great events in sports. There are a few bigger spectacles to end a game than penalty kicks. Some people don't like them because they think it's sort of a cop-out, but there's really not much more of a pressure situation. It's one kick. Either you make it or you don't. If you don't make it, everybody's looking at you as the reason the team lost the game. And sure enough, Patrick Schulte, the goalkeeper of Columbus Crew, steps up and saves the first two kicks from Tigres. Absolutely studly moment by him. Columbus makes their first three kicks. Their fourth kick taker, their star, Cucho Hernandez, actually put one off the post, allowing Tigres to tie it up 3-3. So you can imagine the kind of pressure that is on the final kick taker in this situation. You had the lead. The other team has now tied it up. You have one kick to either win, or if you don't make it, it goes on into sudden death at that point, and with the other team having significant momentum. And the kick gets buried into the bottom left corner. Game, set, match. Columbus is moving on to the CONCACAF Champions Cup semifinal. That is the first time in franchise history that they've done that. This was actually the first time that an MLS team has beaten a team from the Mexican League, Liga MX, after having not won their home leg in the tie. So a lot of history was made last night, and who knows? From here, Columbus, they will now get to play against either CF Monterrey, which is a team that's won this tournament five times, most recently in 2021, or they will get to play against Lionel Messi and company in Inter Miami in the semifinals, which is a big, big deal. And if you want to look even further than that into a potential final, they could be playing the final at Estadio Azteca, literally maybe the most vaunted, biggest ground in soccer in North America, because Club America is on the other side of the bracket, and they're just straight killing teams. So this is going to be very fascinating to see how this plays out as well. Congratulations to the Crew. You guys absolutely deserve it. Absolute legends. Love you guys.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this episode of Living Off the Land. 279 in the books. Appreciate you guys listening as always. Thank you so much. You can follow us on social media.
at Stefano.Steven on Instagram or at StisMcGee on X.
You can follow me at Daniel J. Ford. You can follow the show at the LOTL Podcast. Hope you guys have a great rest of your week and weekend. I know I'm going to enjoy it. Weather be damned. But, yeah, so for Champ, who hasn't really moved in the last hour, there he is. He's behind me. For Steven, I'm Dan. You've been listening to Living Off the Land. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you next week. See you.